This morning I'm interviewing David Attic, the 1st of August, 1997. Start to think about what Houston was like and what was going on in the art community when you came back. When you grew up, did you grow up in Houston?
No, Huntsville.
You grew up in Huntsville. Yeah. And tell me what year, as an adult, a young artist, you came back and what was going on and who were the people and what did it feel like?
Okay, first of all, I graduated from college in Huntsville in math and physics in 1948 and then went straight to Paris and studied with Fernand Léger for 2 years. Then came back to Huntsville in around Christmas 50 and then moved to Houston in spring of 51 and opened a little art school and invited Herb Mears, my old colleague from Paris, who we were students together with Léger, to come down from New York, and we opened this school together. He was working as a window dresser for Abraham and Strauss in Brooklyn, so he was glad to get out of there and have some other sort of thing. So he arrived on the train. I went out and picked him up in a little pickup truck with his trunk
of stuff,
you know. And so we opened this little art school, and it didn't work. We made the basic mistake of charging people after they came, you know, rather than getting a commitment from them.
Okay.
So we didn't make any money, but we had a lot of fun and met a lot of people. And
where was the art school?
The art school was on Truxillo Street between Main and Fannin, and all the action was right there in those days, because 2K's was 3 blocks away, and that was the night action for all the theater people and the writers, the newspaper people. The town was small in those days. Rudy's, the best restaurant, was right next door.
Was that on Main Street?
On Main Street, almost corner of West Alabama. Then there was a little art gallery. Roy Jacobs' wallpaper thing was an art gallery also. The only real art gallery that was selling contemporary art was the Butte Gallery downtown, run by the young impresario Ben DuBose, who they had hired out of the University of Houston to come and basically liquidate their prints. They had a big inventory of prints. Everything was prints in those days. It was a big store downtown whose big business was wallpaper and paint, but who had a little room in the back, about as big as this room we're in now, where they sold framed prints. And in those days, prints were everything, those Pushman prints and all that stuff. So they weren't doing well, so they hired Ben DuBose to come down and liquidate the prints, have a sale and sort of wipe out the business. Well, Ben came in and saw that they could make this business go because they had a little frame shop part of it. And he said, let's try to make a going gallery out of this. And so then Ben started bringing in artists, and I was one of the very first. There were several portrait painters. Robert Joy was the only guy in town that was really making money. And Buck Shewitz. Buck was a watercolorist that actually was in charge of producing the Humble magazine.
The Way.
Yeah, and so Buck was one of the first people I sold a painting to, in fact. It'll come back to me who some of the early people were. There was a gal named Edith Buchanan. Well, she formed the Art League of Houston. She was the first president, I think. And the first membership, little catalog published, to my knowledge, I did the cover for.
For the Art League?
For the Art League membership catalog. I've never seen it since, and that would have been 1951.
So back to DuBose and that, you mentioned there was one other gallery. What was, you had Roy Jacobs, you had and Butte, was that it?
Of the galleries that were doing contemporary art, that was it. There were other galleries that were selling the traditional stuff. Most of the paintings were sort of sold by decorators. Fingers, I think, had a few original stuff out on South Main. But by and large, the galleries that we think of today as that have changing shows and all that, that try to keep up with contemporary stuff, there were none. Roy Jacobs wasn't literally a gallery. They just had paintings along with their wallpaper and stuff. Yeah. So DuBose, Butte, James Butte Gallery was really the only one. In the beginning.
Where was that gallery?
That was in their big building on the corner of Caroline and McKinney Street, which is about where the park thing downtown
exactly.
is.
Exactly.
Somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big three-story building, and their whole ground floor was this big retail business of paints, wallpapers, and frames.
Well, when did Ben become more really active? When did it become DuBose Gallery, and when did it move?
Okay.
Did it move over to West Gray?
It moved to West Gray.
But it was still Butte then.
It was Butte then. Yeah, they decided when everything was sort of moving out of downtown, and, you know, the first store to move out of downtown was over on Shepherd, which was where Frost Brothers were. It was Battlescene. So they sort of set the concept that people from River Oaks didn't necessarily have to go downtown for everything. But until then, every store was on Main Street, Foley's and Battlescene's and Sackwitz and later Neiman's and so forth. So River Oaks Shopping Center was showing lots of good signs of being a deal. So James Butte took a space out there.
What's his background?
He was born and raised in Georgia. He was in a paratrooper. Came to Houston, went to the University of Houston, and I think studied business. But he always had a flair for decoration. But I think his major was in business at University of Houston. And he was just a young guy that was hired to come and do this thing at Butte. And then he turned into sort of the impresario for art galleries. That was in 51. And in about 53, I think it was, they moved to River Oaks. And they were doing very well. I know that when I went to Japan and around the world for 2 years, they were there at West Gray, and that was in 57 to 59. I was gone. So then when I came back from Japan in about 60, 61, I talked Ben into opening the gallery on Kirby. In fact, I was a two-thirds owner because I had the money. And Ben had the expertise. I was a one-third owner. Ben was two-thirds. I was one-third. I put up most of the money, and he put up the expertise. And so he just left. He announced to them, to Johnny Butte, one day that he was leaving the gallery and opening his own, and they closed the doors.
Well, this is not about 1961?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. About 1961.
Now, who was he showing in this gallery?
Oh, by then, he'd gotten together a pretty good group. I mean, about 12 or 15 good people. Other than myself and Herb Mears, it was Charles Shorey, Charles Pebworth, Lamar Briggs, who was working just down the street. And Bruce Monicle was one of the artists at DuBose also. Then when Ben got cancer of the eye and died exactly 1 year later.
So when Ben died in 72, so he had the gallery for 11 years.
I might be wrong about that date. It might be closer to 65 than 61.
So then he died in 72.
Uh-huh.
And then did Stanley come right in there?
No, Stanley was in there before. It sort of made Stanley the manager on the spot. Stanley was a football player student at Rice from Katy, and Ben had taken Stanley in as sort of a godson, you might say, and Stanley lived at Ben's house on Ferndale Street.
Mm-hmm.
And so Stanley had no training in art at all.
Didn't you live in that house too?
I lived upstairs in that house for the summer. I lived there one summer, but then it was my studio for several years in the back,
mm-hmm.
upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
We built that. In fact, I built that. When Ben...
That big addition on the back?
Yeah.
See, a friend of mine bought that house here.
Oh, really?
So
yeah.
And who's in that house? And then it became a children's store, and
it's been through a lot of change.
Yeah.
Well, Ferndale Street is some sort of magic
mm-hmm.
thing. Well, that house belonged to the Domeniles. They had bought it for Jerry McCaggy, when they brought her from San Francisco.
But did she live in that house?
She lived in that house, and she died in that house.
Really?
Yeah, and she had done a lot of the artistic sort of look that it, and she put in bookshelves and did a lot of stuff that made it kind of interesting. So the Domeniles had it for sale and no buyer, and so Ben bought it from the Domeniles, from Dominique. And then he went over and did a lot of his stuff to it. And there was I think that room in the back, which sort of looks out on the little garden, was already there. And then I built my studio above that room. Mm-hmm. And the entrance to mine was upstairs through
the back?
Through what was a little television room.
Okay.
But there was also an outside stair, like a fire escape that I used also. And I was there for 3 or 4 years, I suppose. But lived in an apartment right across the street. I opened Love Street Light Circus in 67. That was the hottest psychedelic club in town. Love Street Light Circus and Feel Good Machine. I have a poster of it. It was a nice spot for kids. It wasn't a bar. It was only Cokes for kids, for underage, you know, for 15 to 20, if teenagers, right? Yeah. And it was psychedelia. First one, the only one in Houston. And it was the same year that the whole thing started in San Francisco with the Fillmore Auditorium. And I was out there that New Year's Eve, 66, 67, and just fell in love with the idea of projected light, of psychedelic light shows. Came back to Houston. A friend mentioned that building down there as a studio loft space. So I went out and looked at it and didn't want to go downtown to paint. I'd already gotten one other little studio downtown, which I didn't like, didn't go to. It was just kind of a mess getting out of it. But I saw immediately the potential of this big room on top of being a nightclub for kids. So I developed that deal. It was the hottest thing going.
What year was that?
That was the great year, 1967. And this is the 30th anniversary right now. And Diverse Works is going to try to reproduce that room in September as the 30th anniversary.
But it's here?
Yeah.
How long did that thing go?
It went wildly one summer and tried to stay open through the next year. But the following summer, I opened one just like it in San Antonio for the World's Fair, or the Hemisphere, which failed. It was a miserable flop. The whole fair was a flop.
Yeah.
And that put me out of the nightclub business once and for all. I had this big business with tremendous expenses and stuff.
All right, let's go back to art. Now tell me
there
about
other galleries
the other galleries.
You've got Meredith.
For instance,
there was a Louisiana gallery, and I tell you who can tell you a lot, and that's Joan Crystal. She started on Louisiana Street over there somewhere near, in a big old house near Brennan's in there. I've forgotten who she had primarily. Kiko opened down on Lovett. It was a very good gallery. Very good.
I love it.
About next to the Alliance Francaise on the north, on the south side of the street, in the middle of the block there. One of those big old houses.
Okay.
You remember Boccaccio?
Yeah.
Across the street and a little bit west of that,
okay.
In the middle of the block.
Okay.
Parker Cushman had a very nice gallery down in Montrose around the corner off of Westheimer. About where Numbers is now.
Oh, on Lower Westheimer.
Lower Westheimer, yeah.
What were they showing?
Parker was showing, mostly it was sort of French import stuff, or anybody that looked kind of French. They love
French sort of, Impressionist.
No, French modern, more Dufy and Bernard Buffet and the Paris School. They were all sort of showing Paris School. And I think Parker Cushman, his daughter is still around, were importing Paris School of stuff, I think. Those are the big days. That's when the gallery business really started to flourish.
Which is in the late 60s, you
which
think?
Was the in the early, all through the 60s. I'd say the early, all through the 60s.
I have gotten the impression that the galleries were very sophisticated.
They were. They had great openings.
They had great openings. They were showing international work.
They were, yeah.
Kiko was showing Miro, and what did Kiko show?
I remember that she had a woman sculptor from New York, something that was very good, and Tamayo, maybe? The openings themselves, which were on Fridays primarily, were the social event of the week. And that was where you saw and met everybody. And they were good, and they were a lot of fun. They were very active, and the shows were covered by the press, and it was the Bill Roberts, Maxine Messenger covered.
They were socially covered,
yeah. And they were a lot of fun, and it was very exciting.
Now, go back to the Euler and,
okay.
and Chilman and
okay.
all that, and
all
the,
right.
end of the show.
All right. Every year they had this marvelous show called the Houston Artist Annual, and there was $100 purchase prize and other prizes. And I submitted to it the first few weeks or months I was in. That would be the spring of '51, and was awarded the purchase prize. And the judge was William Lester of the University of Texas at the time. When the show opened, he came over for the opening, and I didn't have the first prize, but had an honorable mention. And so he went up to Ruth Euler and said, just a minute, I gave the first prize to this man. And she said, well, after you left, we discovered that he hadn't lived in Houston for a full year, and that disqualified him for the prize. He says, we'll make it up to him somehow. He quoted me. He told me this 2 years later. So the phone rang one day, and she said, would you like to have a one-man show in the museum? And I said, is the Pope a Catholic? So I had the first show. It was called the Corridor Show, and it was upstairs. The entrance, of course, was on the south side then.
Right.
You go in and go up the stairs, and there's that long corridor, which
right.
takes you into the galleries, the other wings down. And it was all across that corridor, and so I didn't have much stuff. They're mostly gouaches from Paris, because I just got back from Paris. And I had everything I had, and Ben had framed some of it and whatnot. And our first buyers were people. Buck Shewitz bought one off the wall. Nina Cullinan bought one. So it was a great success.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, that might have been where I met Ben. No, actually, I'm going to backtrack a little bit. The Art League sponsored a show in the garage of the Shamrock Hotel. It's one of those exhibition spaces, you know, you went through
was
the
garage. Like in the...
That was at the early spring of 51. That was, I was brand new in town. Herb hadn't even arrived yet, but he sent his stuff down, and I had them on the wall, his drawings, framing all, and he sold some too, and he was not even in town yet. Well, we got a marvelous, Robert Joy saw the show, and just came unglued and said, this is the freshest, newest stuff. So he called Nina Cullen, who came over and bought one, and two or three other people. I can't remember now. Well, people that aren't that well known. Jane Blaffer Owen.
Mm-hmm.
And and then Ben. That's where I met Ben. And so Ben had just developed his downtown gallery, and he says, come down and show with us. So I had a show down there just a few weeks later. And John DeMille bought the biggest one for $100. It was a big, it was 48 inches square. It was a red still life. And other people bought stuff. So that was the beginning of my little career being launched and selling it and realizing I could actually make sort of a living. I had another job. I was a draftsman for an oil company by day, but was painting by night, you know. But then that gave me the confidence to quit that job and paint full time. And that was all due to that luck, because if I had just won the prize, I would never have had a one-man show at the
MFA.
That was such a prestigious thing. And Ann Holmes was new in town. She reviewed that.
Did you bring Herb into DuBose? I mean, are you
yeah,
all kind
yeah,
of meet
yeah.
Ben together? Or?
Well, I was already at DuBose when Herb arrived, so it was just natural that he
right.
joined it. Yeah, yeah.
Well, now, Herb mentioned that you all started at that art school that you mentioned
yeah.
earlier.
Studio School of Contemporary Arts, the name of it.
How many students did you have?
We had about 10 or 12, and some of them are still old friends. Charles Farrington was one, who later worked at the museum, who now retired to Pueblo, to Antigua.
All right, now David.
And his wife, who was, they weren't going together then, was one. And, go ahead.
What I wanted to ask you was to think about, when you look back over, what stands out to you about Houston?
First of all, it was small and very friendly, and the museum was the center of it. If I were young today, that age, I'd probably feel that this is the greatest time, and I'd be in Montrose at the River Cafe or the El Noche, Cafe Noche, and think that it was the biggest thing going. But then there were a lot less people. I mean, there couldn't have been, of the men, serious artists, there weren't over six or seven.
Uh-huh.
There was Shorey, Jim Love, you know, those that were trying to do anything sort of new and contemporary. And there were women of probably the equal number. And then there was Robert Joy, who was the staid moneymaker. He was the portrait guy, who was the friend of everybody, but not on that cutting edge type thing.
Talk about selling shares in yourself when you went to Europe.
Okay. I needed to go to Europe, didn't have any money. So I thought up this idea of selling shares in myself, and I wrote up this document, and I printed it on blueprint paper because I was working for an oil company, and I sort of tatted the edges so it would look kind of like a document, you know. And it outlined, and I still can't find a copy. It outlined what I want to do. I want to go to Europe, paint, bring back paintings, and guarantee everybody who bought one unit for $50 a painting and one copy of any lithos that I did while I was there. Well, I came back 14 months later. By the way, I went, this is incredible, stayed in Europe for 14 months on $1,800. Is that not incredible? And, and while I was there, I bought a car for $400, but then sold it for $400, so that was a standoff. And I lived in Barcelona for $25 a month in a penthouse and couldn't spend a dollar for a meal, that sort of thing. Anyhow, I don't know how I did it.
Well, this is 53?
53 and 4. So I got back, and we had a party at the Bows in which I was to deliver all the stuff. And so somebody put the word out to Time Life, but the photographers were there, and they interviewed me extensively and took all these photographs, and I have the photographs.
From Life Magazine.
And they're stamped on the back, property of Time Life Magazine, you know, on the back.
Did they air a publisher?
No, they didn't. It was due to be printed the next week, and some other story bumped it, and that happens all the time. It was never printed, but I have all the photographs. And they were very thorough in their interview because they thought it was a neat idea. And
was the museum supportive and cooperative with the local artists at that time, or was it?
They had the museum school, which Lowell Collins was the director of, in the basement.
Right.
So it was a meeting place. They had a Coke machine and sandwich machine and whatnot. So it was sort of the meeting place for artists to be. But as far as them showing stuff, no, Chilman didn't have any real interest in local arts. I believe the first director that really did do a lot of contemporary stuff, most of it was New York City, was the Irishman, Sweeney, James Johnson Sweeney, right. I even went into an abstract period, and he awarded one of mine the first prize at Longview, Texas. He was the judge of a show in Longview. It was a big abstract thing of mine.
Yeah.
So he was one of the first really high-energy national guys that came along.
When did the Contemporary Arts Association kind of solidify?
It was here before I came. My feeling is that it probably started in about 48.
Okay.
And they had a little A-frame building right next to the Noble House downtown on Dallas Street. And that was a lot of fun. That, again, was a small, highly centralized, active deal. And they had great shows. The first show I ever saw there was a Tamayo and a Van Gogh show that John DeMille had brought in. A Van Gogh show. That was rare. Even Fine Arts hadn't done anything that big. And the Tamayo was all watermelons and all pink, you know.